This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest is Barry C. Lynn. Barry is Director of the Markets, Enterprise, and Resiliency Initiative. He's a Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, and he is the author of Too Big to Fail, about the dangers of monopoly capitalism. His newest book is titled Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism, and the Economics of Destruction. It's about the power and destructive influence of corporate giants, corporate predators. Any regular listener to this program certainly knows something about that. Barry's book goes into a lot of detail. It's an important book. It's one I thought needed to be talked about on this program. Barry, I welcome you.
Oh, thanks for having me today.
Oh, it's great having you on. Oh, you wrote an important book. You really wrote two of them. I didn't read the first one, but you're on the same topic. And I would say this is the core subject of our time, because the power of these corporate titans is so immense that they pretty much decide whatever will go on. The government's in place, certainly in this country. They're there to do their bidding. And their bidding is extremely harmful and destructive to the great majority of people, not only in this country, but most every other one as well. And unless we find a way to change this, to stop these people, I shudder at the kind of world we're heading toward. It's a vision that's a very bleak one to me. And I honest to God have no doubt that's where we're going, unless we can stop them. But talk about your book and maybe go back to the beginning, what got you to write the first one, and now a follow-up, and maybe you'll make it a trilogy. And I urge you to do it, because this is big stuff.
Well, thank you. And what got me going is I've been a business journalist for about 25 years, and you know, I really write about how people go about doing business. And I actually ran a business or helped run a magazine for about 7 years. So I know what people go through trying to keep businesses alive and keep jobs and, you know, keep job positions open. And what got me to do this is about 10 years ago, I started to notice something strange about the way that industry was being organized around the world, and that basically, what was happening is that certain supply systems, so it could be like a semiconductor, a certain type of semiconductor was coming only out of one place in the world, say, you know, Hsinchu, this place in Taiwan. Or perhaps it was like a certain kind of chemical was only coming out of a certain place in China. Or, you know, certain kind of electronics components would be coming out of a certain place in Korea. But, and this was like something that was really quite radically different from earlier, where you would have multiple sources of supply spread around the world. And to me, it struck me as, well, anytime you got all your eggs in one basket, it's just not a wise idea. So I started to sort of try and figure out who was thinking about this, how this happened, and what we might do to alter it if someone didn't have a plan to sort of regulate this wisely. And that led to my previous book, which is, you know, if you've been listening carefully, what you're hearing here is a tale of Too Big to Fail. You know, essentially, my last book was talking about Too Big to Fail, not in the financial system, the banking system, but in the industrial system and the production system. What we've seen, and the basic problem here is that we've seen monopolists. And that's what sort of got me to write my second book. But by the end of my first book, I realized, well, the problem here was not some dysfunction in trade law. It was essentially a dysfunction within our competition policy, in which we had allowed monopolists using corporations here in the United States or nation states, which is another form of corporation abroad, to gather control, grab control of 100% of some activity. Now, there's a whole bunch of reasons that's bad. I mean, it's bad because of pricing. It's bad because it maybe leads to slower innovation or no innovation. It leads to less production. But what I focused on with the last book is it also means that the system itself is very fragile. Just like what we saw with our banking system in September of 2008, where we saw the whole system almost go down because Lehman Brothers went down, we now live in a production system in which if we lose a city or even a single plant in some cases because of a natural disaster or a political disaster, you know, some kind of a war, just a spat, you could see this thing that's called an industrial crash in which large parts of the industrial system go down. And that in turn would probably trigger, in many cases, a financial crash. So that's what I wrote about in my last book. And then the second book, what I realized is sort of having seen this sort of monopolization take place within the industrial system, I said, well, what's happening in the rest of our political economy? So while I was doing the second book to kind of retell the same story in a different frame, not the frame of trade law, but looking at competition policy, antitrust law, I started to look at all these other areas, what's happening in our retail sector, what's happening in the foods that are put before us in our stores, what's happening with our beer and our drugs, what's happening to us as workers, how it's affecting our jobs, how it's affecting our wages, this concentration. And what I saw is this basically, we're told that we live in the world's most perfect, competitive, freewheeling, free market. And the actual truth is that it's almost the exact opposite, which is that we live in a system that is almost entirely controlled. There's hardly a single open market in this country left. Almost every single system is controlled, it's governed by a very few people using their corporations, private governance through private corporations.
Oh, very definitely, Barry. It really is a frightening vision, and I remember a comment that one of my guests made, not on my program. The comment was made in another that I heard in a separate interview about the power of the major banks in the country, and that the comment was made about Goldman Sachs, I guess the poster child for the predatory banks just fleecing the country dry, and we get to pick up the tab by bailing them out when they get in trouble, and that's a separate story. But the comment came out of Indonesia from a cab driver saying something like, "Why do you let Goldman Sachs run your government?" I mean, that's an Indonesian cab driver's view. It's taken a long time for people in this country, Barry, to wake up to the fact that, these guys really do have far too much power, and they can pretty much dictate what they want. Their officials are in the top positions in government, and it doesn't matter whether it's Republican or Democrat, and talk about bringing the whole system down. Well, my goodness, if any sector of the economy outside of the military, if they wanted to throw one of their super weapons at a segment of the economy or a key plant or a key city, I guess they could bring it down pretty fast, the fastest of all. But outside of that, no sector can hurt not just our economy but world economies more than the giant financial interests. That can just like Samson, bring the temple down over the heads of the people who live here, you, I, and everybody listening to this program. These people have an awful lot of power, and the phrase that I like, if anything is too big to fail, Barry, it's too big to exist. I'm sure you'd go along with that.
Absolutely. And that's actually why I'm actually pretty optimistic about our prospects, that we are going to prevail in this coming struggle, because we have no choice but to prevail. Because when you have these systems that are too big to fail, you have to fix them. Because one thing that we know about human life, someone will always do something stupid someplace. Or something will happen. There'll be some act of nature, giant earthquake someplace. And that's just the way the world works. So then what you have to do, and we've done this with many other systems. We've done it with our internet. We do it with our electrical systems. We do it with complex systems like ships. You know, we put compartments into them. And we can do the exact same thing with our industrial systems and our financial systems. It's simple engineering. It's creating redundancy and resiliency. We know how to do it. We used to do it in the past. So we look at the system as it's now structured. We realize that it cannot stand, that it will fall. And, you know, just simple common sense will lead us to say we have to fix this. So, and it's already happening. And, you know, I say that one of the reasons I'm optimistic is that recently I spent some time in the UK talking to people within, of all places, the Tory party, the Conservative party over there, the party of Margaret Thatcher. And, you know, the events of September 2008, when the financial system almost went down, it woke up a lot of very important, powerful people to the fact that the present system is not stable and it has to be fixed. And so they actually called me in to talk to me about my own work. And to the extent that there is an establishment in the world, you know, the British lords and barons, that's the establishment, you know. And they want this fixed. They realize it cannot stand. They're actually starting to take actions. So that's one reason for hope. And I think there's actually a number of other reasons for hope, and it's actually one of the things I've been doing recently. You know, there's all of these independent businesses spread all across the country. You know, that, you know, the average American, one of our dreams is to run your own business, right? You know, so people who, you know, own your own farm or own your own store, your own restaurant. And what people are suddenly realizing is that another one of our myths is that this is a good place, the United States is a good place for running a small business. So, in fact, there was a study that came out recently that showed that of the 22 richest countries in the world, the United States, in terms of the percent of the population that runs its own business, has fallen to second to last out of the 22 richest nations. Second to last. Below those socialists in Sweden, below the French, below the Japanese, we are above only Luxembourg. So what I've been doing recently, I've been talking to different groups of independent entrepreneurs, independent booksellers. I'm going to be talking to independent beer brewers. I'm going to be talking to independent farmers. And what you see is, like, all these people have been fighting their fights in their little spaces. They've been fighting, if you're a bookseller, you've been fighting Amazon, you've been fighting Walmart, you've been fighting Barnes & Noble, all by yourself for all these years. If you're in beer brewing, you've been fighting Anheuser-Busch, you've been fighting South African breweries, which is Miller Coors, for all these years, all by yourself. Farmers fighting Tyson's, fighting Monsanto, by themselves. But when you bring these people together, and you bring them together with all the people who want the jobs that the small entrepreneurial businesses will be creating, if they're given a chance, we have incredible numbers in this country of people who will go out just to make sure that they have the freedoms that they have always enjoyed in the past. They will go out and they will organize and they will come together. And these are people from both parties, and from the libertarians and from the independents, and we will prevail.
Well, I hope you're right. I hope you're right, Barry. Dear God. Boy, what an understatement that is. I dearly hope with all my heart that you're right. I have very strong misgivings myself. I see what's going on. I was part of small business myself most of my working life, and from the 1960s until 1999 when I retired, and a long time ago. And it seems like a different world to me now, just not the same. I think it's a lot harder for small business to match up against the corporate giants that have gotten so much bigger during the years. So many of them were the clients that we did business with, and maybe they would be today. I honestly don't know, but the feeling I have is that we're the ants and they're the elephants, and they just trample all over us. And I mean, they can crush us and just sweep us away like we don't exist.
Well, it happened in the past. I mean, this happened back at the turn of the last century. I mean, we remember the turn of the last century that there were giant industrial combines like, Carnegie Steelworks, Rockefeller's oil company. But what we don't remember so well is that's also when they started to create the first real chains. There was the chains like Woolworth and Sears, and the A&P, the Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, which is this giant grocery chain. And then these Wall Street financiers, whenever you see a chain, what you have to understand what a chain is, it's a Wall Street financier that's using this corporation to basically fence in all these properties, all of this opportunity that used to belong to the people. You know, but not that long ago in this country, we had all, the business of delivering groceries to communities was spread among hundreds of thousands of family businesses. The business of delivering glasses to people, eyewear, optician work, that was spread out among tens of thousands of families. The farming work in this country, it was spread out among millions of families. And what the corporate people on Wall Street do is they use these corporations and they say, well, we're going to just fence this in and we're going to have this for ourselves. And all you people who are independent entrepreneurs, independent proprietors, you're going to be our clerks. You're going to work for us. You're going to do what we tell you to do. And then we're going to walk away with all the profit. And we're going to, basically dictate what happens in your community. But what happened, this happened once before, and we actually beat them back once before. We beat them back starting in the mid-1930s, during the Second New Deal. And what happened is after the Great Collapse, FDR initially, after the first New Deal, their initial effort was to basically try various forms of corporatism and socialism and get everyone in the room and try, and they actually suspended antitrust law for a while, get everyone in the room, get everyone to work together, and it didn't work. Corporatism doesn't work. And jobs don't come out of big government, and jobs don't come out of big corporations. Jobs come out of little corporations. Jobs come out of little entrepreneurial operations, of little upstart businesses. And what happened is that after the failure of the first New Deal, and after Judge Louis Brandeis on the Supreme Court led the Supreme Court to say, tell Mr. Roosevelt, and he said, Mr. Roosevelt, no more of this concentration nonsense. We don't do that in this country. We don't do that. And the power, at that point, the Second New Deal began, and the Second New Deal was run by the people, working through Congress. And what they did is they spread that, they used laws, to various types of laws we didn't even talk about anymore, but it was laws like the Robinson-Patman Act and Miller-Tidings Act, and they were designed to spread power out away from the corporations, away from the chains, away from the New York financiers and the London financiers, spread it out to the communities. And it worked. And the reason when you were running your small business or when I was growing up in Miami, that there were so many independent families in this country running their own businesses is because the law protected them. Or actually didn't protect them, it protected the markets in which they brought their labor, they brought their ideas. And what's happened in 1981 is that the Reagan administration overthrew those laws. And what they did is, they destroyed our marketplaces. When they talk about free markets, all it means is that we're free of markets. We don't have markets anymore. But the important thing here is that we beat them once in the past. We distributed the power out to our communities, to our neighbors, to ourselves, and we're going to do it again.
Well, I have to ask you, Barry, of course, so far, we certainly have not done, we have not gone in the direction that you're suggesting. everything the Obama administration has done thus far in office is to go in the opposite direction. What do you see happening to turn this around and head more in the direction that we did in the 1930s? People were hopeful that we would have a second New Deal, and there really would be government help for small business, for individuals in great need during this terrible economic storm that we're going through, and the idea that we're now the worst is over and we're going through a recovery. I mean, this is absolutely this is a big lie. We absolutely are not turned around and going into a recovery. We have a very fragile situation. The official data that comes out obscures the real rot underneath. So we get an employment report that says we lost 36,000 jobs yesterday. Ignored is that we have record numbers of people who have simply dropped out of the workforce because they have kept looking for month after month after month, and they can't find whatever they want except maybe to be a soda jerk someplace. And they were trained to do something bigger than that, so they drop out of the workforce, and they're simply not counted anymore. What a way to figure an unemployment rate. Anybody who hasn't looked or worked at least an hour in the past month simply isn't counted. But these people want a job. They want to go to work. As far as I'm concerned, they're unemployed. How do you think we're going to turn this around?
Yeah, they are unemployed. So the numbers are far higher. Some of the figures I've seen, 16, 18, coming up on 20% of the population, the working population, unemployed. You know, because it's not even just this recent crisis, but there were all these jobs in the past where people kind of got squeezed out of their areas of expertise. And, you know, their jobs were taken offshore. You know, some giant trading company said, oh, you know what, this skill that you've developed, this idea, this technology that you've mastered, sorry, we're giving it to the Chinese to work on. We're going to import it. And there's nothing you can say about it because we are a monopoly. We got the power. We own this market in this country. So go home. And so a lot of people went home even before this crisis. So you're absolutely right. I mean, the magnitude of this crisis is huge. And what is disappointing about the Obama administration is the fact that they really don't seem to be cognizant of this. They're kind of playing around the edges. They're, you know, playing around the margins, and it is profoundly disappointing. I remain very hopeful that Mr. Obama himself, he's a very smart person, and I remain hopeful that he will come to see the light. But it doesn't necessarily matter. We shouldn't. One of the things that Obama has taught us is that we should not wait for saviors. And there are so many people in this country. He thought that we had elected the savior. And you know what? He's done us a fantastic favor. And he's proven that there are no saviors in this world. No one person is going to come and fix it for us. We, the people, have to fix it. That's his great gift to us, the people. No saviors. No one's going to do it. We got to do it.
And well, we got to do it.
That one of the reasons why people have been so slow off the mark here is because we don't necessarily understand what's going on, because we're using a language. We're using the wrong language to describe what's going on around us. We use this nonsensical language that the economists have come up with. You know, we've outsourced the part of our thinking, the part of our brain that we're supposed to use to understand our political economy. We've outsourced it to these guys, these numbers guys, who just sit in their little ivory towers, these, you know, ivy-covered, you know, buildings, and then they like sort of look for the reflection of what takes place on our earth. They look for it in the face of the sun. They see nothing. So once we turn our own eyes onto our own world, once we use common sense to see what is in our world, what is taking place in our own communities, we will understand what needs to be done. And once that sort of that wisdom percolates up from the people into Washington and into New York, then our government will start to function again. Because right now, one of the things that's the problem is that there are these ideologies, this free market ideology, this nonsense that comes out of the Chicago School, this nonsense that comes out of the arch conservative groups. And it just, it's you know, we have to take down our government. We need deregulation. It's just nonsense. It's idiocy. And the fact, what we need to do is use our government prudently to recreate real markets that are open for real people, that allow people to bring their work and their ideas to trade with each other, that give people the capital they need to do this. And that's actually one of the things I do in Cornered, is I really make an effort in my book to talk about, you know, here's the language that we used to use to, until a generation ago, this is the language that we used to interpret the world around us. And here's, you know, here are the people, here's how these other people who wanted to concentrate power in their own hands, in the hands of their friends, here's how they subverted our language. Here's how they took away our history. You know, it's like, how many people in this country know that power was once concentrated in this country and that we took it back in the mid-1930s? How many people know that story? How many people know that we had a socialist era in this country, corporatist era, in the 100 years ago, in which you had J.P. Morgan basically running the economy for us, acting as a king? We don't know that. That history has been taken away from us. But we have this incredibly rich tradition that we can reach back into, the tradition of Jefferson, of Madison, of Brandeis, and it's a tradition that leads us to distribute power among ourselves, which is it's not just the right thing to do, it's actually the safe thing to do.
Well, it sure is. J.P. Morgan, if I remember my chronology right, passed away before the establishment of the Federal Reserve in 1913, end of 1913. But he was, in effect, he was so powerful, such a financial titan, that he was like the head of the Federal Reserve before we had one.
Yeah, exactly. During the crash in 1907, he's the guy who
did he die in 1907?
Everyone ran to him. Washington ran to him. All the other bankers ran to him, and he did all the calls, and he sort of kept it together.
He was the deal maker.
But the reason
he was the power behind the power.
What's so crazy about, say, like these people are trying to take down the Federal Reserve, is the reason we created the Federal Reserve was to create transparency. It was to give us something, a way to look into the banks, to understand what these dudes were doing. Because back then, things were pretty gosh darn corrupt. Because basically, Mr. Morgan and his little cronies, his little team of cronies, they basically decided who got to thrive in this country and who not. They gave out monopolies to some people and they took them from others. They gave it was just like a king. They gave out property and they took it back when they felt like. So it's like, if you don't want to live in an autocracy, and I don't think most Americans want to live in an autocracy, then we only have one choice, and that is to use our institutions, like the Federal Reserve, use our government, especially our antitrust powers, our anti-monopoly powers, use them prudently and wisely to take down, take apart these overly big institutions and distribute the power out ourselves.
Well, absolutely. I must add also, Barry, that regular listeners to this program understand very well what the Federal Reserve is. The Federal Reserve, of course, is the private banking cartel. It's run by the major owners. The most important major owner are the banks at the New York Fed, otherwise known as the Mother Fed. They are shareholders. Each of the 12 districts, the major banks, are the shareholders in the Federal Reserve, and Ben Bernanke is what economist Michael Hudson calls a useful idiot.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. The way it is structured now, I mean, there's been a takeover of the regulator. But the thing is that to fix it, you don't get rid of the regulator, you use the regulator. And, you know, the idea that...
Well, he's not a regulator. He is a facilitator.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way it is right now. So it's like, but the thing is that we can't, if you get rid of it, we have to actually use this stuff more prudently. And, you know, what was done, you have to remember that with the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, it was the Wilson administration. It was the only people's administration, the only Democratic administration. And I'm not saying that the Democrats today have anything to do with the Democrats of Wilson's time, but it was the only Democratic administration of any real you know, that had like a real people's agenda, and that, you know, between basically the end of the Civil War until the New Deal. And the, you know, so the effort there was to take away the power, the banking power, from these few people. And, you know, it worked for a while. It's been corrupted. We have to make it work again. But, you know, make it work again, we don't get rid of it, we fix it.
Under Woodrow Wilson, of course, we got the Federal Reserve, as you well know, Barry. Why don't we take a brief break so you can catch your breath, and we'll pause for about a minute or so, and then come back. We'll pick it right up where we left off.
Great.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Thoughtful, provocative, cutting edge. The Ask Dr. Eisenstein Show. Other doctors will scare you of the disease. Dr. Eisenstein will scare you of their treatment. Dr. Eisenstein is a practicing physician for almost 40 years and graduate of several prestigious medical schools. Since 1973, he has been the medical director of Home First Health Services in Chicago. The majority of the 23,000 families in this practice deliver their babies at home, breastfeed their children, choose not to vaccinate, and use natural treatments whenever possible.
Hi, I am Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. If you want to hear the other side of the story, tune in every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for an hour of questions, answers, and lively discussion. Call me with your medical questions. I would love to talk with you.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back. We're talking with Barry Lynn. If my connector is listening, I could barely hear what was going on during the break, so I wasn't alerted exactly when to come back on. Maybe you can do something about that. If the host can't hear what's happening during the break, then the host doesn't know when to end the break and get back on air again. So something else that needs a little bit of adjusting. But if you remember where you were, Barry, maybe you can pick right up again. I just made the comment that where the Federal Reserve was created, Woodrow Wilson was our president. And there's a great quote from him that I used a couple of times in things that I wrote, that later on, this guy was a former law professor. He was no dummy. He knew what was going on. And yet later on, it was a long paragraph quote, but the punchline of the quote was that, referring to the Federal Reserve, that the passage of this act, Federal Reserve Act, in December of 1913, ruined the country. That was his words, that Federal Reserve Act ruined the country. He was the president who signed the act.
Yeah.
It never would have been passed if he didn't sign it.
No, you're absolutely right. But the thing is that at some point you need to have some public regulation of the money supply. Now, this was an imperfect solution. It actually worked relatively well for large periods during the 20th century, you know, basically during the New Deal era, it worked, you know, which, and when I say New Deal era, I say from 1935 into the 1980s. So it worked well because you had, you know, real technocrats, you had a sense of common interest in the country and the nation state because of that was during the Second War and that was during the Cold War. So, you know, people treated these institutions well and they used them for the public purpose. But there are huge flaws in the structure of it that need to be fixed. And, you know, but the But we do need, at some point, the public has an interest in regulating our money supply. That's just a basic thing. Jefferson spoke about that. He said, how can we allow these bankers just to, you know, create money at their whim and destroy it at their whim? You need someone there regulating it. And, you know, the basic thing about the government is, you know, I mean, if you're not using government, someone's using it against you.
It's certainly being used against us. I and my listeners will not argue with you on that point, Barry. Not at all. I mean, it very definitely is being used against us. We have a government that seems to be at odds with the needs of the people. The government is handing out the best numbers that I'm aware of is since Obama has been in office, plus what was begun under George Bush, we have handed the bankers $12.7 trillion. And according to Neil Barofsky, the TARP administrator, we have pledged $23.7 trillion. $23.7 trillion. At the same time, Obama says we cannot tolerate these big budget deficits. So he wants discretionary budget cuts.
Yeah, no, he wants to take a few panties out of all our pockets to, you know, cover these numbers. I mean, no, it's you know, being a banker, it's an awful good business to be in these days. But you know, the interesting thing, you know, is a lot of these people. I mean, I think this is going back to what I said before about the Tories, is that there's a lot of people, a lot of these them that we talk about, these people who are in the catbird seat, who are like people who are driving this system, a lot of them know that there's something profoundly wrong here. A lot of them know that there has to be reform. I mean, we see this with Volcker. I mean, Obama, let's give him a little credit. He actually did come finally around to this idea of some kind of separation in the banks or some kind of a structural reorganization. It wasn't enough, and it was too late. But he did come around to it. So that shows that he has the ability to learn. But the fact is that, you know, we're seeing people within the establishment, within power, say, something is wrong here. We have to do something about it. And there's a lot of people in the upper levels, in the elite, who are truly profoundly patriotic Americans and want this experiment, this republic, to continue to succeed. They don't want, you know, it's not worth it to them to destroy the system in order to put a little bit more money in their pockets. So we're going to see people who we now regard as, you know, essentially the other, the enemy. We're going to see a lot of people there helping us out. But you know what? We have to get out there and demand it. You know, it's like the Tea Party. I don't see a lot of people in the streets in this country other than the Tea Party folks. And, you know, and they're kind of being manipulated to a large degree. When the people of the United States get out and say, you know, enough's enough, here's what we want, here's the basic things we want, we're going to find that on the other side, there's going to be a bunch of people over there who are going to help us out. This is actually the truth. That we've seen this in the past. We've seen it in the Anglo-American tradition numerous times, going back even before our own revolution. And because of these people, you know, they understand that, you know, they want their children to grow up in an independent republic, and they want there to be an independent republic of independent citizens.
Well, we have a lot of repair work to do, Barry. My goodness, industrial strength repair work. We just have a terrible situation on our hands. I really worry about it. I'm old. I'm 75. I'm old enough to remember when we had a lot of bumps along the way. I'm sure you ran into it in small business. Anybody in small business knows that when you get into an economic storm, the small guys get buffeted around a lot more turbulently than the big guys. And they can handle it pretty well. The small guys can get capsized and literally taken down in the undertow. And I can remember a few times that things got mighty nasty. I mean we wondered if we were going to be around the next week or month or whatever. And somehow we got through it all. And I imagine that we never went through anything like what we're going through now. And I'm certain that if we had, we would have been blown over, gone, and that would have been the end of the game altogether. So I have to believe that many small businesses are literally being dragged to oblivion. We see the results with the banks that are going under, the small banks. We hear about the closures all the time. And I've had people on this program say they expect hundreds more banks to go down. When it's all said and done, we could be talking about a couple of thousand banks that will literally disappear. The one topic that we haven't brought up yet, it's something that obsesses me also. I don't know whether you'll agree with me on it, but I've seen this script before, and we're seeing it again, that the economic crisis was not happenstance. This thing was engineered to happen, manipulated by the Wall Street titans to bring the system down so they could remove competition, so they could buy up the pieces that they have an interest in at pennies on the dollar, very cheap. And, of course, even the big guys have gotten bigger. We've discussed on this program the fact that, and I absolutely am convinced of it, that the companies like Bear and Lehman, they didn't go down. They were pushed. They were pushed. And
no,
they,
I mean, you're absolutely right. People were pushed. I mean, I study too big to fail. I look at these large industrial systems. You know, I look at the large financial systems. You know, the people who actually get it, no one would actually ever tamper with the system in that way. From my own experience, because the likelihood, I mean, we barely avoided a cataclysmic event in the fall of 2008. And a cataclysmic event, it serves no one's interest. No one comes out as a victor in that. There's no property left to gather up. But that said, I mean, what you see, and, you know, you have these are really, really smart guys who, you know, run Goldman Sachs, run Morgan Stanley. So when there is a crisis, these guys are very, very swift to move to take full advantage of the crisis. So, you know, I don't think that any of this was premeditated. I don't think anything was, you know, was basically, you know, triggered on purpose, because these, you know, that was really scary and it scared the serious people. But you know, these guys, you know, they're smart. They move fast. They grab what they can. And you know, so, but my sense is, you know, what we have to do, and there's going to be more crises, and that's why, you know, that's one of the things I write about with Cornered. There's going to be more crises. We have to really hope that they're not going to be, you know, the cataclysmic in nature. It is going to be significant. And what we have to do on our side is we need to prepare the analysis so that we're ready to move. One of the reasons that we didn't do a good job, the Obama administration did not do a good job, is we didn't have the analysis prepared. We didn't have the tools ready to put into place. So we have to, I spend a lot of time talking with people in government, you know, in government in Asia, in government in Europe, government here in the United States, and there's a lot of really, really good, serious people out there, real technocrats, people who believe in the system, people who sacrifice their lives working for government salaries, which really aren't that good, and there's so many good people out there. And what you need, they just need to get them together and give them the opportunity to develop the plan for what we're going to do when the next opportunity presents itself. And that's, the crisis will be the opportunity. We didn't have the plan this time. We need to have the plan next time. We're working on the plan. There's a lot of people in this town working, I'm in Washington, and we're working on the plan. So, you know, my sense is that we've moved. We're actually, what happened is that the ideology, the free market ideology, took hold of so many brains the idea that we just let the market guide us took hold of so many brains in this town that, you know, when it didn't guide us to a safe harbor, people were truly surprised. They're not going to be surprised anymore. They've been awakened. And that's a really good thing. So, I mean, the reason I wrote Cornered is precisely to help people, to help shape the language, shape and frame the solutions so that when the next opportunity presents itself, we're ready.
Oh, dear. I fear it. Well, one of the corporate titans, well, I don't know if it was one of the corporate titans, but some big deal business person made a statement, probably several of them did, and the quote went something like, "A crisis is too good an opportunity to waste."
Yeah.
I mean, this is the great moment when they can step in and, you know, it's vulture capitalism gone wild, where they can just go in there and buy the stuff they dream of at a price they never thought they could get. And I have to add that I have a darker vision than you do, Barry. I absolutely believe that there was no happenstance about what's going on now. I believe this absolutely was engineered. But what I see happening is we have been through, or we're still going through, phase one. There's a phase two coming. And I fear, I don't know, I don't have a clear vision of the future, but I strongly fear that phase two will be a lot worse than phase one, and millions of people will be grievously harmed by the next phase of the crisis as we move back into it again. And again, my dark vision, I could be wrong, my dark vision is, again, this is the plan. This is the plan, that to have a worse calamity, to harm many, many more people, and I think part of the plan is to simply strip away the safety net of the country of people. So we want to get rid of the great social programs. Well, part of it is very visible, Barry, extremely visible. It's in Obama's health care plan, $500 billion or more dollar cut in Medicare. If that isn't a visible stripping of one of the two major pillars for old people like me, Medicare and Social Security, I have no doubt in my mind that they absolutely...
Oh, yeah, there are people, I mean, it's like the whole Peterson operation.
Oh, yeah, the Peterson operation wants to end it, but they're writing the script.
But, I mean, the thing is that it's very... these guys, they also don't want to do it. I mean, they don't... You cannot control a crisis. A crisis has its own dynamic. So... the idea, and so I mean, I agree with you that there are really smart people who are doing really bad things in this country. Absolutely, no question about it. But the idea that they would be engineering a major crisis, it's like too dangerous. And we're talking about events that could basically just shut everything down forever.
I think they want to shut everything down.
There wouldn't be anything to control. There wouldn't be any minions to lord it over. So if your dream really is to be the next feudal lord, you got to have something standing in order to be, you know. Otherwise, you're in it's such a anarchic situation that if you overdo it, if you overplay the crisis, if the crisis takes on a dynamic of its own, no one is going to be able to control it, and who knows who's going to be in charge, who knows if there's going to be anything to be in charge of. So, I mean, but I think you're right. I mean, you're fundamentally right. There's some really, there's some powerful people doing really bad things. I don't entirely agree that, with the means that you're suggesting, but, but it doesn't matter. Just the fact that they're trying to do this anyway is wrong. Just the fact that they're cooking up, fake crises. I mean, I'm talking about, sort of financial crises that they, it's like my friend Dean Baker talks about this a lot with Social Security and stuff. They cook up these fake financial crises so they can cut it. They don't need to have a real significant physical collapse because they can do it just by cooking up these ideas, putting them out there, and the fact is that they already got most of what was put in place during the New Deal. They've got our properties, they've got our jobs, they've got our unions, they've taken it all. You know, it's like Social Security is like, you know, that's just kind of an afterthought. So it's already been done. The revolution has been won by them, but now we have to have the counter-revolution. We have to take back what we lost. And it's actually, and the fact is, we're just waking up now. Until a few years ago, most of us thought we were, you know, thought things were just fine. We're taking money out of our houses, going down to the Home Depot, buying a bunch of stuff, building it, going on vacations. You know, so it's we're a little bit discombobulated. It's just happening, but we're waking up. We are being enlightened, and we will use our new wisdom to guide ourselves to a better place.
Well, if change will come, the kind of change that we're talking about, Barry, it will have to come from the people. The people will have to make the change. Again, the direction we've been heading in is really the exact opposite direction of that. And the big changes, if you look back through history, I have a fair sense of history. If you look back, the big changes that have happened just in this country alone have been changes that ordinary people, through their own efforts over a sustained period of time, and it doesn't have to be millions of people. It can be a fairly small number of very determined people who simply won't quit on something they want badly enough. So civil rights became big, but it started small. People that absolutely were determined to make it happen, and they finally did. But the politicians never did these things until the people forced them to do it. That's the way big change always happens. The people at the grassroots forces the politicians to do things they never would have done otherwise. And when it comes to business, the bigger these corporations get, the more power they want, the more wealth they want. And we live in a zero-sum world, Barry. They can only get it by taking it from us, so that's what they're doing.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
companies, the big banks, the J.P. Morgans, the Goldman Sachs, they rigged the system. And a company like Goldman Sachs, over a period of 100 trading days, they only had over 100 day trading period or so, they only had one losing day. And, of course, they're not really banks anymore. They're casinos operating for their own accounts and, oh, by the way, whatever else they do on the side. But how can any operation, like flipping a coin and you're going to call it right 99 times out of 100, and when you call it right, you're going to strike it big. Well, that's what Goldman Sachs does. Well, the only way they can do that is to rig the game to come out on the right side for them. If you run the roulette wheel and you got a little switch underneath, you can make it come down, that little ball come down wherever you want it to come down, and that's what Goldman Sachs does, and that's what the J.P. Morgan does. What kind of a system is that? That's why we're getting.
No, I wrote about that in Cornered, and you know, in one of my chapters, I look at how they ran the price for oil.
Oh yeah,
and they ran, and it's like we have to understand, it's like the reason oil hit $150 last year. It wasn't the Saudis, it wasn't OPEC, it wasn't Exxon. We have to, you know, it's very important that we train our sights on the real actors here, the real malefactors.
Yeah, absolutely.
Goldman Sachs and Company. They ran,
the market manipulators.
They manipulated the price of the futures contracts, and they ran them up, and they pocketed all kinds of money on the trades. They pocketed money selling the insurance, the price insurance they called derivatives. They pocketed money on the up. They pocketed money on the down. They knew when it was going up and down. They could make bets. It's a wonderful way to operate. And then the Saudis and Exxon were saying, hey, guys, it's not us. It's not us. We want oil at 70. In fact, the Saudis and Exxon have taken their oil, the oil that they trade, Argus Sour, they've taken it away from NYMEX, from the New York Mercantile Exchange, because they wanted to get it away from the hands of the folks at Goldman Sachs. So we have to figure out, it's part of this is like figuring out who are the people who are serious who are going to help us. And they may be people that we're not used to thinking of as people who are going to help us. like in the case of taking back power and oil. We may, you know, working with Exxon, working with Saudi Arabia, maybe we'll end up with a nice fixed price for oil that lets us all go about our lives, not worrying about whether the price of gasoline is going to go up, you know, double, triple over the course of a few months. You know, that would be a much better way to live our lives. It's the way we used to live our lives. We got the models. We know how we did it before. You know, it's just a matter of we have to figure out, we have to be a little bit more, you know, if we just say, oh, it's just going to be this little clique of progressive people, it's going to be this little, and, you know, we're not going to work with the Republicans. We're not going to work with the teabaggers. No, we got to figure out who among the teabaggers, who among the libertarians, who among the Republicans, who in Exxon, who in Saudi Arabia are going to help us. Because there's a lot of serious people out there who want this world fixed.
Oh, indeed.
And we're going to find once we open our minds and we open our eyes and we open our hearts and we start to find, work with people, we're going to find all kinds of help.
Barry, it's the only reason that I'm involved in this radio program and the writing that I do. I absolutely want this world fixed. There are a lot of younger people than myself. They deserve a better future than the one I see coming if we don't fix it. And I really had something to look forward to when I was their age. And if we don't go to bat for them, then they're going to have a very, very dark future unfolding for them. So we need to roll up our sleeves and do what we can. And I'm committed to do it. You sound like you're committed to do it, too. We just have to keep spreading the word. And the more we do, the more people will be mobilized to all of us pitch in, roll up our sleeves, and work for that world. Oh, we are coming to the end of the program, Barry. Many thanks for coming on. You wrote a terrific book. Have you got another one in mind?
Well, I have a couple. There's my editors and my agent are trying to get me to sign on to something.
If I do another one,
it would probably be sort of this book, The Cornered, was very much it's a reported book. It says here's what exists and how it exists and why it exists and what used to exist. It's so that we understand. That's why I wrote Cornered. Next book I think would be, here's what we should be building. This is the vision that we should be building. And, we actually have in our own past really quite wonderful examples. You know, the Democratic-Republican example. When I say Democratic-Republican, it's that was the name of the party of Madison and Jefferson.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Oh, that music means the next program is going to be coming on. Well, Barry, I hope there is another book, and I hope I can get you back and we can talk more about it because, as we know, this is big stuff. It doesn't get any bigger than this.
Well, thank you for having me, and, we got a mission.
Oh, indeed we do. Again, Barry, many, many thanks. And join us again tomorrow. We'll be on same time. Make this a regular habit.
This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.